You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. We have another great show for you today, some questions and answers. But before we get into it, Susan, congratulations on your most recent CNN
interview. Thank you. I was actually really pleased they represented what I said accurately. I was a little nervous when it comes to that, you know.
Absolutely.
I got to rely on them to actually present what I said. So, yeah, absolutely. It was, it's interesting. And, that interview was last week. Now it's Monday. So actually the week before, and then that came out this past week, toward the end of the week. And in the days since then, there's been some additional things coming out, supposedly, and it's being reported on different stations. So and not the South African Times that said we were clemency experts, came out on CNN, one of the places that came out and said it, that the that some staff members have been terminated.
Right.
That's one or more. They did say employees with plural for unauthorized access of Maxwell's inmate email account. Apparently it was communication between her and her attorney, and it was accessed inappropriately and presumably printed and sent out to Jamie Raskin, who then released it to the media. And so for the complaints regarding things like, and this is what we talked about, in the article, what I talked about was you got to have the full context. Something can appear to be preferential because it's different than what's normal. But unless you have the full context, and if the Bureau became aware that her email were compromised, her inmate email TrueLinks account was compromised, in order to afford her attorney-client, that attorney-client communication, they might have opted to use the warden's email, which again would be something you would not usually do. But if she had been compromised, and regardless of what you think of her or her offense or who she was associated with, the Bureau has an obligation for care, custody, and control, and to protect her. She still has rights. So it's kind of interesting. We just kind of, when we were talking, I just kind of emphasized the importance of kind of exercising a little bit of caution when you don't have the full story. And it sounds like there may have been more to the story. So we'll just, kind of have to wait. So it was interesting. Like I said, I was pleased to see my comments were accurately represented. So
that's good. That's good. Yeah. Gotta be careful. I know. I was on the line with you. I thought, okay, come on. And yep, held the line really well. And had some good conservative things to say. The thing with the special meals, I know that they don't have the kosher kitchen anymore, but, right, there may be common fare meals or whatever that could be.
And according to reports, she has been receiving, or she had requested, even back to her pretrial phase, that she had identified as Jewish and was requesting kosher meals of, while her mother was Anglican, her father was Jewish. And the Bureau allows folks to self-identify when it comes to faith preference.
Yeah.
And if you identify as Jewish, then you are entitled to kosher meals. And I think in Bryan, somewhere like when she was in Florida or when she was in New York, where there would be a larger Jewish population, that wouldn't have been seen, receiving the special meals wouldn't have been unusual. There would be more a larger Jewish population in the middle of. How would you describe where Bryant's located? Is that South Central Texas?
Well, yeah, South Central Texas. Yes.
Geography wise, I know where it is, but
or more almost dead central, but yeah.
Yeah. So you know, what does that Jewish population look like? And are in fact they were preparing separate meals to accommodate, you know, religious fare is something. And there were other things that were brought up of whether or not they were being delivered to her, whether she was getting visits outside of normal periods and things like that. And again, I have to say, like, until you have the full context, you know, when you and I were at Carswell 100 years ago, had an incident where we didn't have a high profile, well, had high profile inmates, but didn't have a high pro. It wasn't a high profile inmate, but a high profile visitor. And as you know, those who are familiar, when we have weekend visiting in the Bureau, ordinarily there's only a couple of officers assigned to the visiting room. And this particular high profile visitor, who shall remain nameless, was causing quite a stir. And
you could name the visitor if you wanted to. I mean, it's all.
No, I won't do that. I won't do that. He was causing a bit of a stir and signing autographs and things like that. Was getting approached about signing autographs. And myself, along with a couple of other folks who were weekend, you know, case managers, unit management staff that were had weekend coverage, were asked if we could come to the visiting room to provide a little extra supervision. So, I had to come down to the visiting room and help out. So, and he was told, you know, you're not allowed to sign autographs and such.
Yeah.
So
crazy stuff.
Hollywood celebrity.
Well, all's well and ends well. Yeah. With that.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Had some great questions.
Yes.
Had a couple posted today to our post about questions. So we'll probably start with those.
Yes, and let's start with those.
Just kind of looked at some of the last few days. And we had some ones, you know, a lot of times we're getting the same questions. FSA, how much time am I going to serve?
Mm-hmm.
But we had some different ones. So I thought it'd be kind of some good stuff to talk about. Had a question about whether we thought the Bureau... well, the Bureau and really the courts, but the Bureau would be supportive of, or the courts would be granting more compassionate releases. Good question. I'm going to say at the moment, no. But as another person actually shared, another person on our page shared today, there is a case in front of the Supreme Court that was argued this week, or actually it would be last week, end of last week, maybe this week. Anyway. Already argued that consolidated two cases, Fernandez and Rutherford, and was actually looking at whether the extraordinary and compelling circumstances line in the compassionate release reduction sentence statutory language could include things that are typically argued in a 2255. So it will be interesting to see how the courts rule on that. How the Supreme Court rules. If they rule in favor of that is an option, then there could be more opening for compassionate release arguments. I mean, you know, extraordinary and compelling is has always been something that's kind of generic in its in its language, but from the Bureau's perspective, it has always been, and I suspect will continue to be, unless the Supreme Court rules otherwise, circumstances which were not known at the time of sentencing. So, you know, whether it's your circumstances with your family, and you know the you as a caregiver, but you're not the sole caregiver. You know, the courts knew that at sentencing, whether it was something your health, all of those kind of circumstances. If the court knew about it, the Bureau's position is the court knew and didn't take that and, you know, considered it and dismissed that. So we'll have to wait and see how it goes. It'll be interesting to see. That's a it'll be an interesting case. For those not aware, the Supreme Court hears cases throughout the year. And then starting in usually mid to late June and into July, they start issuing their decisions. So that will be one to kind of put on the calendar to watch for next year.
Okay.
So,
okay.
If the decision is status quo, then no, nothing will change. That's my opinion. Okay. That's not a crystal ball. That's just my opinion. Other question we had was with regard to FSA question and the worksheet. And I actually see different versions of this question. The worksheet planning section where it provides all of those dates assume the credit in place. So if you are earning, in this case, the question was, if I'm earning 15 days, if the person is now earning 15 days, that conditional release date, that conditional release date, the halfway house date, the conditional placement date, those are set. It is not that,
they're going to stay the same.
The release date with the earn credit will change month to month until the person hits 365 days. But those conditional dates, barring some change in the status of the earning status, gets in trouble, goes out on writ, goes in transit, or, you know, goes, at, you know, all of those negative things that can happen, goes to SHU, not for admin, but for DS. And, you know, when you go into DS status, you fall out of earning status. All of those kind of hiccups that could impact programming days, and if they impact programming days, they can impact time credits that will change that. But that's the only thing that's going to change that date. Or a sentence reduction. If you get a sentence reduction or you get more a larger sentence, you know, if you get prosecuted for something additional. So, but once those dates are there, they're there. It's not going to change.
Okay.
So let's talk about some other non-FSA stuff.
Okay.
So had a couple different questions regarding jail credit, concurrent, consecutive, that kind of language. So thought just spend, and we've talked about this briefly before. A person's sentence starts with the judge sentencing them. So whatever day the sentence is ordered, that is the sentence. Anytime before that date is what is known as prior custody credit, or more colloquially known, it's jail credit, right? That's what we all hear talk about, jail credit. Officially, it's prior custody credit. Jail credit is that credit for any time that a person is sitting in custody related to the arrest, related to the sentence, right? And that time doesn't get caught up with another sentence, a state sentence. So if a person is arrested by the state for something and the feds slap a detainer on because they were also eyeing you and the state just happened to arrest you, okay, that doesn't mean you're serving federal time. That means your primary custody, and this is a kind of a legal term, primary jurisdiction versus secondary jurisdiction. Your primary jurisdiction is with the state. Now, if the state drops their charge, sometimes states do that. They dismiss in lieu of federal prosecution. Maybe they just decide they're going to let whatever it is go. Who knows what it is, right? Maybe it's a misdemeanor that they picked you up on and now the feds got you and it's just a fine, right? When the state releases you from that time, when they say, nope, we don't want him, now you become federal, primary federal. And as long as you're primary federal, you are collecting jail credit. Now, what if you get arrested by the state and you bond out? So you got you get arrested by the feds. You do your thing, you go in, you issue, you get your bond, you leave. You're there for a day or two. Maybe you're there for a little longer. It takes you a little longer to get that bail together. you get it together and you bond out a week later. You were in federal jurisdiction for those few days. Those jail credit days, you're going to get to apply. Except, let's say once you bonded out, you got in trouble with the state. Now you're in state jurisdiction, primary jurisdiction. And now the state prosecutes you. They give you credit back to when they arrested you. And they arrested you, they prosecuted you, they sat you in jail. And somewhere along the line, the feds writted you out, prosecuted you. And your federal judge is trying to help you out. And he says, I'm going to run it concurrent to the state charges. Awesome. That means your federal sentence can start running on the date you were sentenced. That time that you were in jail with the state doesn't count. Because you can't double dip. You can't get credit for two things at the same time. And a detainer doesn't mean that somehow you're getting federal credit. Okay. And this can be confusing. And there was a lot of times I'd stay in mainline. And the first thing I was asked, like, who arrested you first? Were you picked up by the state on a federal warrant? So they picked you up for the state because they pulled you over for, you know, you were speeding and they ran your plates and they came back. You had a federal warrant and they arrested you. That's different because they arrested you on a federal warrant.
Right.
But if you were drunk driving and you were arrested for drunk driving and you're sitting in the jail and the feds go, oh, hey, and slap that federal detainer on you, you're state custody. You always have to ask that question. Who arrested you first and why? Bonding out is a relinquishing of jurisdiction. So if you bond out on the state or the feds, if you were with the state and you bonded out and then the feds pick you up, the state gave up their jurisdiction and vice versa. Right. If you're sitting in a halfway house doing your federal time and you decide you're going to leave and not come back, that's called an escape. Escape will result in the loss of primary jurisdiction by the feds. And if while you're out on escape status, you pick up a state charge and the state arrests you and want to prosecute you, well, your federal sentence has stopped running. And then let's say the feds decide they're going to prosecute you for the escape. So you get like an extra year or two on an escape charge. Now you have the remaining unserved portion of your federal sentence plus the new federal time, except you're sitting in the state. And then the judge says, oh, and we're running your sentence consecutive. Consecutive versus concurrent. Concurrent, you can start serving your sentence even though you're in state custody. On a consecutive sentence, you're out of luck. You're sitting there doing not dead time because it's with the state. So you're doing your state time, but you're not getting any federal credit. And then that marshals put a retainer on you. And when you finish your state sentence, the marshals come by, pick you up, bring you back into federal custody. Then you start serving the remainder of the time that you escaped on. And then you serve the escape time, the escape sentence. So let's see, detainers. Yep, that covers everything we wanted to talk about there. It can be confusing, especially if the days are close. Important part of that is keep your documentation. Keep your documentation. I can't tell you how many times I was like, well, do you have your documentation that you bonded out? Well, it was with the state. It wasn't my federal case. Well, guess what? It can impact. So that's super important. Another thing that came up with regard to jail credit is, and this has come up a few times, federal time credits. The answer is no. You do not get federal time credits for time when you're sitting in a jail. And there have been, I will say, there have been a few courts that have ordered the Bureau on individual cases to apply, calculate time credit after sentencing, but while they were still sitting in a jail. I would love to see one of those cases work their way to the Supreme Court or for Congress to fix the statutory language to be painfully more clear. From the Bureau's perspective, and not surprising, I agree with this. The way the law is written, credit is not a function of your sentence, right? Good conduct time is a function of your sentence. So you give 5-year sentence, 5 times 54, that's your good conduct time. You don't have to do anything else. When it comes to time credits, you have to complete a risk and need, the risk and the need assessment. You have to be assigned classes. You have to agree to participate in the classes. You have to maintain your opt-in status and continue that throughout your incarceration to maintain access to that credit. None of that can be done when you're in the county jail. If you're sitting in a county jail, an argument has been made about detention centers. If you're sitting in a Bureau detention center.
Right.
Initial classification does not happen until the inmate has reached his designated facility. There is a time and there's regs on it. These are decades old regulations that spells out the 28 days prior to the first step back. And you guys who have listened to me before know what I've said. There is really no difference with the exception of a few more assessments, a few more things, but the Bureau has been assessing needs, calculating risk, and making recommendations and monitoring programming. That's what the Bureau's been doing for years. We were doing that when I started in 1991 as a case manager, right? Review PSR, right. Look at what the inmate needs, make program recommendations, monitor it. Are there some additional assessment tools that we're using now under FSA? Yes, there are. Is there additional incentives? Time credits? Yes, there are. But that core function of initial classification program review is still there. That does not happen in the jail. That does not happen in pretrial detention. That does not happen in holdover status. That happens when you get to your institution. And if there have been courts, like I said, the reviews are mixed, and I would really love to see a final decision, or for Congress to just make the language more plain in that regard. That would be the best situation. But that's that. But then the other part is aggregated sentencing. So when there's two different types of aggregation. One is you've got the judge ordered you, and a common one we see is you got a drug case and a 924C. And the law specifically says you get, 5 additional years consecutive on a 924C. So you actually have two different sentences. You may have, 60 months on a drug case and 60 months consecutive on that 924C. Those are aggregated together. They're both PLRA cases. They're aggregated together into a single 10-year term of incarceration. Okay. The Bureau does that when you have separate sentences, but a drug and a 924C. They would do that when you have offenses in two different jurisdictions, like you got busted in the Eastern District of Texas and the Northern District of Texas, which are, very close by. In fact, weirdly, they kind of had this weird overlap. Mm-hmm. So you could pick up two different charges in two different jurisdictions. And then you have two different prosecutions with two different judgment and commitment orders. Again, they're the same type of sentence. So they are aggregated together into a single term of incarceration. That's when they aggregate a sentence. Administrative aggregation is when you have sentences that are not similar. So you have a federal jurisdiction case and you have a DC Superior Court case, or you have an SRA case and a PLRA case, which can be an aggregated sentence. But if you get an incident report, then they have to be de-aggregated because the PLRA has different rules with regard to good conduct time and incident reports than SRA does. So they can go from aggregated by sentence versus aggregated by administratively. And when something is aggregated administratively, all it means is they can't fully be combined and they're technically running end-to-end, okay? But the Bureau considers it one term of incarceration. It's not one sentence, it's one term of incarceration. And it runs from the first day of the first one to the last day of the last one. That is a long-standing practice. Was in place before I joined the Bureau. That's how old it is. Decades old. And when it comes to time credits, if any one of the sentences is ineligible, the whole term of incarceration is ineligible. So the question was asked, one of the questions was asked about the person who was serving the 924C and now is serving something else. Ordinarily 924Cs are tacked onto the back end. So it would be the reverse.
Back end, yeah.
But if you had a 924C with, for example, an SRT violation, then the SRT violation could be on the back end with, because it would be a violation to the previous term. But regardless, aggregation, if one is, it all is. Had a question about drug cases and conspiracy. And the question itself was about a conspiracy case involving fentanyl and an enhancement. If the language on the judgment says conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute whatever's after
841 A1 B1 whatever,
none of that matters because it says conspiracy, and conspiracy to do that, to do a drug case, is 846. Mm-hmm. 846 is FTC eligible. So if it says conspiracy, even if it's for fentanyl, you're okay. There's some other qualifiers in there that could make it not okay, but that's leadership when the prior convictions catch in. That's a little bit, a whole lot more complicated. We actually have a full section of that, where we discuss the details of prior convictions in our book, Unlocking Federal Time Credits. But when conspiracy is involved, doesn't matter what the drug is, what the enhancement is, it's a conspiracy, it's 846. In the case of fentanyl, as a reminder, if you do have a possession with intent to distribute fentanyl, non-conspiracy, unless you've got like 1 or 2 grams, I think it's as low as, there's several different sentencing procedures categories that are qualifying in there, and it's as little as 10 grams. That will make you ineligible, and you don't need an enhancement at all. It can be straight up possession. Fentanyl is the only drug that is the case for. And of course, with heroin and meth, you also need a leadership enhancement. And in the case of serious bodily injury or death, you need to be prosecuted for the B1C, prosecuted under the penalty statute, or sentenced under the penalty statute B1C, which is a 20-year sentence, enhanced minimum.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And that can be any drug. It doesn't matter what kind of drug. And Bruce and I, of course, talked about that. I think it's cherry pick which drugs count and which don't. I think it needs to be, if the serious bodily injury and death is important, and they've put that across them, if the leadership role is important enough on meth, then it should be important enough on cocaine powder or whatever the drug is. So I personally am of the opinion that needs to be standardized across the board, regardless.
Yep.
Whether it's an all or nothing, is my opinion. That's just my opinion.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Jump in.
No. I had a question I was going to ask, but... real quick. Mm-hmm. Did anything happen in November? Everybody was waiting for new changes to happen in November.
Well, the Sentencing Commission's guidelines went into effect. Congress did not vote to not implement them. You know, the way the guidelines work, the Sentencing Commission puts them out. There is a several-month period of time where Congress can act to block them. And if they don't block them, they go into effect. If I recall correctly, those are not retroactive. In fact, they aren't. That was a discussion we had a couple months ago, I think. They voted and they did not approve retroactivity. So those changes don't have an impact for folks sitting already sentenced and in Bureau custody. But if you're coming into custody, if you're dealing with federal prosecution, those new guidelines will be in effect for you. Good. So, but yeah, Congress didn't block them.
Yeah.
They barely could get a budget passed. I don't think they were paying attention to them.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the public website, we see a lot of times people asking questions. The BOP website says my loved one's date is this, but he's saying this. Why, you know, what's going on? Your loved one has his worksheet, and his worksheet says your conditional release date is X. Your conditional placement date is X. You're eligible. Your max home confinement date is this date. Those are not publicly released information. The only thing that is on the public website is the date that includes what credit has been applied. The unearned credit, because in theory, things can happen. And by statute, the credit isn't earned until it is earned. So it's not going to appear on that public website. That public website will include information on your date with your good conduct time. It'll include if you've been approved for 3621E, and it will include the credit you've earned to date. That's the difference. And while I'm thinking about it, loved ones should be sending paperwork home. We see it happen all the time. We see it happen all the time that you know, family members are calling us and we're trying to help out, and we find out that they didn't save it. They got a copy and they didn't save it. Or they went to team and they didn't get a copy and they didn't ask for it. No, you shouldn't have to ask for it. The case manager should have it printed out on the table to slide across to you. But if they don't, ask for it. Your loved ones are entitled to a copy of their FSA time credit worksheet, their pattern risk assessment, and their Spark 13 needs assessment, and a copy of their team sheet. And there's other documents we can talk another time maybe about what's publicly releasable.
Right.
But there's a whole policy statement on public documents and the inmate central file. And we just had a client here a couple weeks ago. We were like, go ask for it. And they're like, but she says no to me all the time. And we're like, go ask for it. And we gave him the policy citation.
Right.
And he got his copy of his document. In this case, it was a halfway house referral. Knowing what you're allowed to have. And like I said, I'm not saying you got to keep it at the institution where other inmates might lay eyes on it. And you don't want them knowing your business. Put it in an envelope, mail it home. Let your family members hang on to them. If you need something, they can mail it back into you. You know, and when they have it and you're running into problems, that's where Bruce and I come in. And that's the first thing we ask folks, like, do you have a copy of this? Do you have a copy of that? You know, and if they have a copy and we look at it and we're like, yeah, there's nothing wrong, like, we're not going to be able to help you. It is, you know, then we'll tell you. We're not there to take your money knowing that we can't help. That's not what we do. Can't say that for everybody. But, you know, if we know there's nothing we can do, we tell you that up front. But if you don't send it home, and we're going to have to do some research and figure it out.
But that's why we have our books, because I think there's this misunderstanding of how things work. And so you don't see something on the public website. My loved one's telling me one thing. You know, what's really going to happen? Now that they're in 15-day earning status, does that mean that this projected date will never change again or whatever? So, yeah, it's a lot, man. It's a lot to learn.
It is. And, you know, and I kind of get frustrated with certain media entities and folks out there that, you know, want to talk about what's wrong with the time credit system. And the reality is the time credit system's been working. Does it have hiccups every once in a while with an individual case? Yeah, we've seen it. It happens. But for the most part, for the greatest number of folks, it is working. Now, the Bureau is taking a more proactive position and putting out more data in the form of like the home confinement eligibility. But that was, like I said, we were talking about it while I was still hired, and trying to get an answer from the previous administration on legally, could the Bureau do that? And it comes down to some of the restrictions under the Second Chance Act, which Bruce and I have our outline. We're going to be working on that new book. We will have it out for the springtime, maybe even sooner if it gets super aggressive, but I'm thinking it'll be springtime. And we're going to be covering the Second Chance Act, and we're going to be talking about the ins and the outs, and we're going to break down the Second Chance Act just like we broke down the First Step Act. It'll include the newest changes from the Bureau in terms of handling the Second Chance Act against the FSA credit. And I think it'll be a really, really good resource. Neither FSA nor SAA are going anywhere.
So good, because we're going to explain the five-factor review. We're going to explain that if you have a short sentence, and even though you hear about 365 days of Second Chance Act, that doesn't mean that you get 365 days. Case manager might even put you in for 365 days. It still doesn't mean you're going to get 365
days. We have some case managers out there that are not doing a five-factor review. They're just referring people for 365 days. And I will say that's lazy. They're supposed to do a five-factor review, but they're putting everybody in for 365 days and then letting the reentry managers figure it out. Like I said, too many years of training, being a case manager and then training case managers, that gives me a little heartburn. But we're going to break down the five-factor review, explain what each one is. We're going to talk about how should your loved one be explaining his release needs. And I've had a few people say, well, I'm just going to tell him he's homeless. I'm like, no, please don't lie. Oh, please don't lie.
It'll bite you.
They can check that. But providing the right information, having the right details is important. So we're going to talk about that too. Like I said, I'm really excited about it. Bruce and I have been talking about it, and we, just kind of got the outline kind of fleshed out today. I saw Bruce posted on the Facebook group about questions. That'll be really good. I haven't looked at it yet. I saw your post.
We want to hear your questions, you know, because we're content area experts and we give as much information as we can. But if we start to see some repetitive questions, which we want to see, then we know we need to address that in the book.
That was the difference between the first book and the first and the second edition on the FSA book was the repetitive questions. We added a chapter on the Second Chance Act because it keeps coming up. We add it, and it did answer questions, but we're taking that chapter and we're just blowing it up and having a full book on it. And we want to make sure we capture the topics that our families and our people on our Facebook need, what their loved ones need. That is the goal. Very exciting. Good stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Good stuff. Good. Very good stuff. So
another question. See this come up too. Applying first step, act time toward supervised release. Now, I know we have a few courts out there who want to do whatever the heck they want to do. I know the Ninth Circuit not long ago put out a ruling that it wasn't the whole Ninth Circuit, it was the 3-member group panel, put out a ruling that said that essentially this extra unused time credits could be applied to shorten the First Step Act. Or I'm sorry, to shorten the unused First Step Act time credits could be used to shorten the term of supervision. There is, okay,
right,
the section of the law that the Ninth Circuit used was an introductory section that talks about the application of FSA time credits. They completely ignored the specific section that said time credits can be applied, the director can apply time credits to advance the transfer to supervised release up to 12 months. The transfer, that the law specifically talks about the transfer from incarceration to supervised release. Now, I will tell you that was probably difficult language, because when the Bureau doesn't transfer you to supervised release, we release you, Bureau releases you, DOJ, BOP releases you, and then you go to and you start your supervised release time, which is probation, under the judiciary. It's two different branches of government.
I was going to say, and so isn't there a sentiment that FSA is more of a executive branch thing and not a judicial branch?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So how the Ninth Circuit came out with this, but so you know, the Ninth Circuit is historically the most overturned circuit in the country. And in fact, when I was a case management coordinator at USP Lee in Southwest Virginia, and people would come to me and say, oh, the Ninth Circuit. And I'd be like, means nothing, because they get overturned, and they haven't been as bad as they were, say, 20 years ago, 25 mm-hmm. years ago, but they're still like, they still get overturned. And their decision, and I read it, was like, okay, I'm going to like have a little old school flashback here. Remember when Bill Clinton said it depends what the definition of is?
Is, yeah.
Yeah, that's what they did. And they were focused on the word toward and totally ignored the section of the law that specifically said it was to advance your transfer to supervised release. So I think they did a huge disservice to a lot of people. I am waiting to hear, but I believe that is being appealed. I haven't confirmed that recently with the shutdown getting information. People weren't in their offices, but with that was when that first came out, we were talking about that and they were looking, waiting, they were assessing it, and the Solicitor General was looking at appealing that. And so we're waiting to see on that one, but that was just a dumb decision. That's about as polite as I can be when it comes to the Ninth Circuit. Let me see here. I had some other FSA. How am I doing on time? Ooh, let me get this one. Couple things. Okay, so short sentences at home confinement. If you have a short enough sentence that your 10% is less than 30 days, it is unrealistic to think that you are going to get any time at all. because you're only able to get time under the Second Chance Act. And the Bureau is extraordinarily reticent to transfer anyone for anything in the community for under 30 days.
Right.
So, you know, you take someone with a 6-month sentence, they have about 18 days. Realistically, they're not going to go. If you have a 9-month sentence, you got about 27 days, 28 days, depending on the calendar, right around 27 days. Maybe you get it, maybe you don't, because it's 27 days. But honestly, if you don't have at least 30 days of eligibility, the likelihood of getting anything is very low. I mean, if your case manager puts you in for it and the RRM approves it, kudos for you. But getting your, like, you need to go in with realistic expectations. In terms of, so that's all I want to say on that. It's just not realistic. And we've seen it with 6-month cases, and it's just, they have these ideas that they're still going to get 30 or 60 days of halfway house, and they're not. And the home confinement is only 18 days. Had a question specifically regarding a person who dropped from medium to low. And it sounded like there was a little bit of confusion in that. And possibly it could have been the case manager. It could have been the loved one. It could have been, you know, like the telephone game as we transfer information. When someone drops from medium to low, if they are, first off, if they're FSA eligible and they're medium or high risk, but they're eligible, they're earning time credits. They don't have access to their time credits, but they are earning time credits. They're earning time credits at the 10-day rate. So if they have been in custody for 18 months, 18 times 30, that's what, do some math here. That's a lot of days. That's a 18, not 30, times 10, that's 180 days that they've already earned. Okay. They just don't have access to it. When they go to low risk, the credit is applied. Now, back when we first start applying credit, and some of the early interpretation was you had to wait. Like, you couldn't apply the credit because there was this 2-assessment period. The decision in the previous administration was no, because your first time that your minimum dropped a lower minimum could also be your last. And in the book, we explained like the background and how it was first understood. But as soon as you dropped a low, you are eligible to apply the credits. Now,
okay, we're 2 minutes, 2 minutes.
Okay.
2 minutes.
You're eligible to apply the credits. To go to 15, you have to have 2 assessment periods where you stay at low. And depending on the time you have, and assuming you have more than a year to go, that's 2 180 days. So you're going to have to wait the 360 days in order to go to the 15 days. But you're at least, you're applying now to your release date. And you now will have a conditional release date, conditional placement, et cetera, all of that. Okay. I'm good.
Awesome.
Walked right up to the end. I had one more, but I'm not worried about it.
We'll get it next time. And well, folks, another great show today here on Around the Block. Hopefully we answered some of the questions. We're going to take next week off for the holiday, but we'll be back hopefully on December the 1st. And we'll either answer more questions and or, you know how it is. We always have plenty to talk about here on the show. Come by and see us on our Facebook group. See us on our YouTube channel, First Step Act. We're on Amazon Audible. We're on Apple Podcasts. And of course, all of our shows are on LA Talk Radio. You can pull our show up and all the shows are there for free, MP3 or MP4 video, whatever you like. So again, we appreciate everybody. Feel free to drop by our Facebook site, ask questions on our YouTube channel. We're always accessible and love to hear from everybody. So, okay. So everybody have a safe Thanksgiving and stay warm and stay well. And we'll see you here next time on Around the Block on LA.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.